All right, kids?
Yeah.
We're going to be arriving at lunch soon. I want to tell you something exciting about what we're going to eat. We are going to a restaurant in a mansion. I'm in the car with Janie and the kids, and this mansion restaurant we're going to is in New Hyde Park, New York, just outside New York City. It's a 19th century historical landmark. What do you imagine a restaurant in a mansion would be like?
Like a humongous restaurant that's super fancy and has super yummy food.
Golden tables and chairs with white tablecloths and red carpets on the floor.
Yeah, what kind of food do you think it has?
I want Caesar salad.
They probably have Caesar salad with gold Caesar dressing.
So how are you feeling now, knowing that you're about to go into a mansion for the first time in your lives?
Excited, but I feel like there's a catch. or something you're not telling us about it.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. McDonald's is everywhere. In fact, it's so omnipresent that when you start a story there, you can end up anywhere. Like, last week, we brought you a story about McDonald's ice cream machines. They're famous for always being broken. We talked with a couple who hacked the machines to try to make them work better, then ended up with private investigators on their tails. This week, we have two more stories about McDonald's. This first one is just a quick little nugget. Then we'll move on to something meatier. So, given that setup, you may have already figured out that the mansion restaurant, the one Becky imagines will have white tablecloths and gold furniture, well, it's a
McDonald's! Woohoo! Whoa, look at that. Here, let's get out.
New York's got this road, Route 25. It was built by the colonial government in 1745 as a military highway. It runs from New York City straight east, all the way to the tip of Long Island, over 100 miles of what for generations was farmland. Today, this road is 100 miles of almost continuous strip malls, big box stores, car dealerships, fast food restaurants, and gas stations. But one relic remains. In the 1860s, a farmhouse on this road was converted into a Georgian-style mansion. It was later used as a funeral home, and then in 1986, McDonald's bought the property. They planned to tear down the mansion, place it with a typical McDonald's, but residents fought the plan. They gave the house landmark status. In the end, there was a compromise. McDonald's agreed to spend millions to restore the mansion, keeping its historic look on the outside while making it a typical McDonald's on the inside. In exchange, residents agreed to let them build a drive-through in the back. And that's why today, wedged in between all those strip malls and gas stations, there's a big white house with columns and cornices. And it's a McDonald's. All right, here we go into the mansion. The indoor dining area was closed because of COVID, but we could still see it. It had high ceilings with big black pillars and a grand staircase leading up to another dining area. There was a wraparound porch that had been enclosed in glass to create another dining area. My first thought, if you're looking to have a nice wedding on a budget, this is an excellent option.
May I please have a Happy Meal? Cheeseburger.
Yeah, so I'll have two cheeseburgers, one spicy crispy chicken sandwich.
Okay.
One medium fries.
Okay,
please.
Soda?
No, nothing to drink. Janie went with a hamburger. Did I mention it was Mother's Day? She's a good sport. We took our food outside, sat on the steps with a nice view of an auto body shop, and chowed down. What do you think, girls?
Well, at least the food's good.
I'm eating my cheeseburger cheese side down.
Smart move. That's my girl. That mansion McDonald's is in New Hyde Park on Long Island. If you hit Mavis Discount Tire, you've gone too far. Now on to our third and final story about McDonald's. This one's our main focus today.
My name is Marcia Chatlin. I'm the author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, and I'm professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown.
Do you prefer doctor or professor?
I mean, this is not class, so you can please call me Marcia.
Like any good academic, Dr. Chatlin, or Marcia, is very committed to her subject matter.
I have a Substack newsletter that's devoted to fast food and teaching, the two things I'm obsessed with.
Okay. All right. I'm subscribing now. Click.
It's called Your Favorite Prof.
Okay.
It's just me writing it. I know. The team and I came together.
As she said, Marcia is the author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. In it, she examines the pros and cons of McDonald's role in African-American communities since its founding. I asked her to read an excerpt about her personal connection to McDonald's.
Growing up, McDonald's was everywhere. We ate at McDonald's before or after church on Sundays. I hosted my friends at birthday parties there. And no matter how many high-end pastries I sample, the chocolate banana birthday cake offered at the McDonald's on Western Avenue in Chicago's Rogers Park is my favorite of all time. My friends and I would pool our orders of French fries on the brown trays after school and chat as we enjoyed our growing freedom. In high school, I would go to a McDonald's in downtown Chicago that was decorated with portraits of Black history makers and prints from Black painters and visual artists before I took an hour-long train and bus commute home. In my financially lean days of college and graduate school, McDonald's was a staple of my diet when I was scrambling to finish term papers and dissertation chapters. I frequented other fast food restaurants over the years, but McDonald's was where I grew up. And for most of my life, I have eaten there and enjoyed it. As I have aged and studied, my feelings about fast food have changed, but my gratitude remains for the many memories I've collected over the years.
I was going to start off by asking you how this became one of your areas of study, but I think that passage kind of answers the question.
Yeah, I mean, McDonald's was, I think, one of the most reliable presences in my life growing up. I mean, I just felt like in the absence of having a lot of family traditions, in the absence of having, you know, grown up in just one home, McDonald's in many ways was like the thing that I always knew was there.
Marcia's connection to McDonald's isn't just about warm and fuzzy memories of meals shared. She says when she was growing up as a Black kid in Chicago, McDonald's in her neighborhood was more than a restaurant. It was a community hub.
It's like, you know who the Black McDonald's franchise owners are if you like grow up Black in certain cities, because they're everywhere. Like, they were on local TV. They're on the radio station telling people to fill out the census and like register to vote. And this was like one of these weird like racial Rorschach tests when I was on my book tour. I, you know, a white audience member would be like, I have no idea who's the franchisee of my McDonald's.
On the surface, it seems McDonald's had a largely positive impact on Black communities. It offered an opportunity for Black people in cities to own a business and create jobs. And Black franchisees used their resources to give out scholarships to local students and invest in education about Black history.
McDonald's, Black franchisees used to sponsor this Martin Luther King PSA short video thing. I used to love it as a kid. It had a song. There was this whole like series of Black History Month content that was on like a cassette tape.
McDonald's made that?
McDonald's Black franchisees like regionally pooled their money. It has like MC Light on it. And the thing that I find really stunning about that is that I'm a historian of African-American life and culture, and I had more exposure to Black history because of McDonald's stuff than I did at school. And I went to like a like fancy like prep school. So I had the best education, but it was McDonald's that would like open up the pathway to my career. Oh, and look at me now, I'm writing these books critical of it.
As a historian, Marcia turns a more critical eye on the place she loved so much as a kid. Because even while McDonald's franchises became pillars of Black neighborhoods, the relationship between the corporation and the community was often tenuous. The standard McDonald's origin story goes like this. The McDonald brothers opened a hamburger restaurant in California in the 1940s. It's a drive-in, so you order at a window or through an intercom, and a server brings the food out to your car. That is the same time as the rise of the American suburbs, expanding highway system, greater access to cars. The restaurant is a hit, so they move to a franchising model. Individual franchisees pay McDonald's a startup fee to essentially own their outpost. The franchisee operates according to the company's rules and has to pay them a percentage of sales. The brothers have a handful of franchises when a milkshake machine salesman named Ray Kroc comes on board in 1954. By 1961, he squeezes out the McDonald brothers and eventually grows the company into a multinational franchising behemoth. As McDonald's is growing in the 50s and 60s, so too is the civil rights movement. Activists are pressuring businesses and government to desegregate, and some of the most famous protests of the era are taking place at lunch counters and restaurants.
When we think about the 1960s sit-in, McDonald's is just like completely erased from that history. Although desegregation of McDonald's was actually an agenda item for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, there were fights in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and Memphis, Tennessee, throughout North Carolina about McDonald's having segregation in their little ordering windows because a lot of them were drive-ins. And, you know, throughout the South, desegregation led a lot of the fast food restaurants to not want to do inside dining because they didn't want to deal with the fact that they would have to have integrated seating. And so like McDonald's has kind of like scooched its way out of that story.
By the early 60s, most franchises do desegregate their ordering windows, but the company turns a blind eye to the ones that don't. Then in the late 60s, in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination, McDonald's shifts their strategy.
McDonald's started to present itself as racially progressive because they were opening restaurants in African American communities and because they were recruiting Black franchise owners. You know, the historian in me is like, wait a second, like, not so fast. You have to kind of do a rewind to think about the origins of this relationship.
And what exactly is McDonald's thought process in the late 60s? They make a conscious decision. We are going to invest in African-American neighborhoods and African-American franchisees. Why do they decide to do that at that moment?
So if you like read some of the material they write, it's because they were so moved by the moment. If you really look at what was happening during the period, there are two things. One is some of the white franchise owners found themselves in neighborhoods that had either through white flight became predominantly Black or had some strained community relations because during the uprisings after King's assassination, there was a lot of questions about white profiteering in Black communities. And so some of these franchise owners wanted out. McDonald's was willing to like transfer them out. And they had made this investment in a restaurant. And so the Nixon administration during that time was also promoting this idea of Black capitalism. And so they were providing money, federal funds, to help minority businesses start. And you have a moment in which the loss of a major figure in the civil rights structure is kind of opening the door to anything could be civil rights.
In other words, there's this idea that civil rights doesn't just have to be about passing laws. Another avenue to civil rights could be investing in Black businesses. Capitalism could further the cause. Now, McDonald's isn't the only one with this idea. In the late 60s, several Black celebrities start their own fast food chains, Muhammad Ali, Mahalia Jackson, and James Brown. Marcia says these stars are motivated partly by this idea of civil rights through business, and partly by plain old business.
People get super into franchising in the 1960s. One, they're seeing the incredible growth of McDonald's. It's the first fast food restaurant to become a publicly traded company. They're also seeing this kind of new landscape for celebrity because after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and there's gradual desegregation of public accommodations, particularly restaurants, African-American consumers are becoming more comfortable in like going to restaurants without fear of violence or fear of rejection. And so there's like all this market potential. There's also the rise of an emergent Black middle class that has more buying power. And so everyone is like seeing dollar signs. And so celebrities also, you know, if you think about like the NFL and the NBA back in those days, there weren't like huge Nike contracts. Like if you weren't Joe Namath, you weren't making crazy money on
your image. Yeah. No, a lot of those guys had jobs in the offseason.
100%. And so they are starting to learn about how to license their names to these franchises. But one of the reasons why franchising was so popular, particularly among African-American celebrities, it was this idea that you could give people a chance to start their own business.
But getting a McDonald's franchise requires a lot of money up front, which for most folks means taking out a big loan. And once you have the restaurant, it's not exactly the same as owning your own business. You're beholden to McDonald's. They own the land your restaurant is on. They decide if you can get a second location, and if so, where it'll be. And if they say you have to upgrade your equipment to add a new menu item, you don't have much say in the matter. On paper, you're a restaurant owner. But in a lot of ways, you're still at the company's mercy.
Absolutely. And I love being a downer because I'm a historian. I'm like, no, this is how it really happened. Like, I'm the worst. Like, don't let me like take your kids to a museum or like help them with their history homework because it'll be awful. So I get that. But with that
Mom,
being...
Mom, Dad, Auntie Marcia told us.
That none of this was real, right? But the reality is that for a very long time, franchising has been presented as the American dream. Like, this is how an everyday person could go into business. I think this is why it's such a double-edged sword when African Americans particularly go into franchising, because this is a community that has been outside of business opportunities. And so they're trying to hold on to this opportunity because this may be their only way into having a business, but franchising is very risky and very high stakes.
And yet, that's a chance some Black Americans are willing to take. McDonald's first Black franchisee in 1968 is Herman Petty in Cincinnati. By 1972, there are enough Black franchisees that they form their own interest group, the National Black McDonald's Operators Association. And despite the obstacles, Black-owned McDonald's start doing very well. When we come back, McDonald's assumes its place as a pillar of urban Black neighborhoods and exposes the limitations of pursuing equal rights through business. Stick around.
Time to cook up some advertisements.
Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman, and I've got a cascatelli pasta shipping update for you right now. The giant shipment of boxes that we've been waiting for since March, it finally arrived. The boxes are in Sfollini's warehouse, and they are filling those boxes as fast as they can, which means many more of you should be receiving your pasta very soon. If you ordered between March 23rd and March 27th, your order will go out by the end of June. Right after that, they'll move on to the next batch. So thank you again for your patience. I really appreciate it. Thank you for all the photos you've been sending of how you're cooking and eating your cascatelli. It makes me so happy to see how many of you are enjoying it. And for those of you who haven't gotten it yet, I promise it's coming. It'll be worth the wait. Thank you. Now back to my conversation with Dr. Marcia Chatelain, author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. As we get into the 70s, McDonald's is adding more and more Black franchisees. And those franchisees are getting some help from the administration of President Richard Nixon.
So the federal government of the 1970s is all over the place in terms of what to do with African-American voters. The Republicans have lost a lot of voters to the Democratic Party, but they have some loyalists. They have some people who are hanging on. And they also have celebrities like Wilt Chamberlain, like James Brown, who are willing to kind of make inroads with the Nixon administration for the purpose of platforming and expanding Black capitalism ideas. And so there's this like kind of like uneasy, awkward, like we are going to get the most out of this Republican administration that we can. Meanwhile, like Nixon is spying on Black activists. He's like telling the FBI to like essentially, you know, disrupt the Black Panthers and different freedom struggles. Like he is like messing with people's lives.
Well, and he won election using the Southern strategy, which, you know, was
scaring white voters into thinking.
It wasn't even really a dog whistle. It was just a whistle.
So isn't that kind of interesting? So he's doing all this like bananas racist stuff. And then he's also saying things like, I believe in Black power in the most constructive sense of the word, meaning I believe in segregated communities. And the way we build up segregated communities is we make investments in business and investments in housing, but we do it in a way that never has to kind of like disrupt any of the ideas about integration.
In other words, Nixon's thinking is use federal programs to invest in Black business so that Black Americans do well enough that they have no reason to leave Black neighborhoods and move into white ones. Regardless of the intentions, Marcia says this increased investment in Black business fills many Black Americans with a new sense of possibility.
From the vantage point of 1968, anything is possible. People who had lived during a period in which African Americans had to fear for their personal safety if they entered the wrong diner were now in a position to create a business where people could ostensibly be treated well, that they could like help youth, that a lot of the early Black franchise owners, and this continues to be a tradition, like they use a lot of their money for scholarships.
So Black franchisees start getting McDonald's, and they do very well. Partly through sheer will, and partly because of a range of other factors.
they do really well because they're competing in a field where a lot of restaurants, a lot of businesses have closed. They are backed by the capital and the strength of the McDonald's brand. And so people who wouldn't be able to get a loan for one kind of business are now able to get, some backing and some financing to open a franchise. They're considered community positive. This is a moment in which Black consumer power is also rising. And then it's also being supported by, some of the veterans of the civil rights movement, people like Jesse Jackson, people like Hosea Williams. Like, they are also promoting business as an extension of MLK's dream. And so it's kind of like a very winning strategy.
And McDonald's takes notice.
Oh, McDonald's takes notice. They realize, they used to call them Black stores. They realize how well Black stores are doing. And the Black franchisees, if they're in this weird position because they are doing well, but they are doing well under some of the most difficult conditions. Their stores have been damaged. They have old equipment. They're sometimes operating in neighborhoods with a lot of high safety concerns. And through this, they form an organization to represent their needs. And McDonald's tolerates it and listens to them on the advertising piece because they know that the Black consumer market is spending a lot of money at McDonald's. And, in the 70s, there was a huge oil embargo. So people are not filling up their cars and going on vacations, and they're not driving to McDonald's. But a lot of the urban clientele are walking to McDonald's. And there's a lot of reason to believe that that urban strategy allowed McDonald's to outperform its competitors in staying strong during the embargo.
As Black franchisees do better and better, they start pushing McDonald's to let them open restaurants in white areas, the exact thing that many white people in power were trying to prevent when they got behind Black business in the first place. According to some Black store owners, McDonald's basically says no.
Allegedly, Black franchisees are only offered opportunities in Black neighborhoods. And if you're white, that you get to choose for whatever you want. And the reason why this becomes important is because we know that depending on the racial demographic of a neighborhood, some of the costs of insurance, some of the costs of taxes in urban areas are different than suburban areas. And so the argument is that McDonald's limits the economic potential of its Black franchisees by employing this strategy. This is what has been alleged for a very long time.
It's like redlining, but for franchises.
You said it, Dan. Yes. People use that language. They use a lot of the language of residential segregation to talk about this franchise issue.
These allegations have been leveled against McDonald's for decades. There have been multiple lawsuits going back to the 60s. Many have been settled out of court. Some have been dismissed. And in at least one, the judge ruled for McDonald's. Now there are two new ongoing cases. Marcia says that in the past cases that settled, McDonald's has never admitted any discrimination.
There was a big case in the 80s involving this guy in LA. He says, like, I want to expand. And McDonald's retort back in the 80s was like, well, don't you want to do business in your community? And he's like, I'm rich. I live in Bel Air. That is my community. And there's this like really awkward kind of like, but you're doing this for your people. And him saying, but I'm rich now. So why do I only get these stores in South Los Angeles? So they settle. And, McDonald's says that he didn't make a cent off of the racial discrimination claims, that we were settling other issues. So that's usually how it goes down.
In the 80s, while these discrimination lawsuits are going on, McDonald's puts more focus on marketing to Black consumers in ways that Marcia says are very positive. They sponsor events like Essence Fest and the McDonald's Gospel Tour, and they feature Black celebrities in their ads.
Michael Jordan, Patti LaBelle, all of these, like Gladys Knight for McDonald's, like this is really significant in a time where there were still questions about whether Black artists could be crossover hits. And like McDonald's has them in all their commercials. Like this is, again, these are not small things. And I really want to recognize how expansive that shift was.
I mean, I have to say, like, I certainly have noticed in the last year or two, a big change more broadly in representation in commercials, big corporate food commercials on TV. When I was a kid in the 80s, McDonald's ads were one of the only places you would see Black families.
100%. The creative material was really, really significant because they were using, for many years, a Black advertising agency. And then Burger King did that. And then KFC did that, right? But McDonald's, like, did it the best.
In the last few decades, McDonald's efforts to connect with Black Americans have also extended to the food itself.
There's some regional specificities that I think are very much attuned to Black customers, like sweet tea in the South, the adding of grits. There was another product that didn't work so well. It was called a McBeef steak, and you're supposed to have it with onion nuggets. And everyone's like, the onion nuggets give you gas. And like, why would you try to eat a steak at McDonald's? But it's so interesting to look at the storyboards around it, because it's all of this idea of like working class Black people being able to treat themselves to something that was like kind of like a steak dinner. But not.
It's interesting. I still keep thinking about this quote that I saw back when the Popeyes fried chicken sandwich went viral, and the New York Times did an article. The headline was "Popeyes sandwich strikes a chord for African Americans." So they have a quote in here from a woman's Facebook post comparing the Popeyes fried chicken sandwich to Chick-fil-A's. It says Chick-fil-A's version, she wrote, tasted as if it were made, quote, by a white woman named Sarah who grew up around Black people. The Popeyes sandwich, she added, tasted, quote, like it was cooked by an older Black lady named Lucille.
Right. So like that's perfect. And that kind of contextualization, right, is like one person has a Black domestic and the other one might actually be the Black domestic. And it's something like I think about in my book a lot, like McDonald's is not a Black business. But in many ways, it indexes ideas about Blackness and ideas about race in order to sell itself. There's a great book about Walmart and evangelical Christians. And she writes, like, Walmart is not a company for Christians, but there's something about it that it's like very much tethered to kind of Southern evangelicism. And I always think that's like such a fascinating way of thinking of these like big brands, the way they try to like kind of merge themselves onto cultures.
In the new millennium, the conversation around McDonald's shifts towards new issues, obesity and food deserts in Black urban communities. But as Marcia explains, you can't separate this issue from others.
We want to see more grocery stores in neighborhoods. That's fine. But I think one of the things that we see in the 2000s, some of the claims against racial discrimination against McDonald's on the part of franchise owners, the solution is open more minority-owned stores. Open more outlets. Well, when you open more outlets, then you have more people that you're feeding in this way. And it's more space that's taken up by fast food and not other types of businesses. So I think like sometimes we lose sight of like, what does a victory mean? This is not about like what people eat. This is about the conditions in which people have to make choices. And one of the things that was really important to me was to not write a book that suggested that a person was bad because their kids eat fast food or they're bad because they eat fast food. But rather, if a person wanted to make a lot of choices about what they eat, do they have that opportunity? And what is the history of limiting those opportunities for populations that don't have the power to call the shots?
So some good has come out of McDonald's investment in Black communities over the decades. But of course, those investments have not addressed deeper structural issues.
You know, with the hindsight of 50 years, we knew that communities could not be rebuilt on the strength of a Black-owned McDonald's. But from the vantage point of 1968, neighborhood businesses are closing and moving away. And McDonald's is like, here's this thing. Maybe this could help. I understand why it was like so seductive.
Right. It's hard not to see parallels to today.
I know, right?
Especially, you know, hearing you talk about, you know, the idea that like maybe business will fix things.
If you look at the conversations that emerged after George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, and you look at any of the major riot commission reports from 68, from, you know, 65, from the 1940s, from the 1910s, they say very similar things, right? Like the problem in our cities, police brutality, poor quality jobs, overcrowded schools for our children, lack of recreational space. All of those things are the origins of the crisis. It's so weird when you write a book during one period of time and the reference points just shift. So like initially, I think my book was this kind of like, oh, this interesting hidden history of McDonald's. But after last summer, it's like, wait a second, this is really weird. These are the conversations about business and investment that we're having now. And it's one of those few kind of approaches to racial injustice that isn't right or left. It's both, right? Like Republicans and Democrats equally will have a vision of economic investment for the purposes of like addressing these issues. And then they will, people will be like, oh, this is such a new idea. And they will ignore like why this didn't happen to fruition the last time.
What's your go-to order these days, Marcia?
Well, okay, so I don't really eat McDonald's anymore. Okay. Yeah, so I just, but here's the thing. I ate McDonald's for years, so like I'm not trying to be like judgy. Like I don't eat, you know, people who say like they don't watch TV. It's like, really?
Like, are you not a part of society?
It's like, how do you not? So I don't want to be like elbow patches McGee. Like I don't eat, you know, fast food. I don't watch TV. Like I'm watching, you know, The Bachelor and Real Housewives all day.
Right.
When I used to go to McDonald's, what I would really love, I liked the Quarter Pounder, the simplicity of the Quarter Pounder, because the Big Mac was too aggressive. You know, you got to get an order of fries and a Coke. I really miss the original apple pie. Do you remember when we were kids? It was like 9,000 degrees.
When it was like deep fried?
When it was a proper fried pie, it could kill you if you bit into it too fast.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I thought the sundae was quite delicious. It was a nice dessert.
You have a baby now, Marcia.
I do. I know.
Are you going to take him to McDonald's?
I just, you know, it's like...
I mean, we're looking far off into the future. You don't have to commit right now.
I mean, I think about this because, you know, my husband likes fast food. He loves Taco Bell. I think someone will take him to McDonald's, probably to troll me. But I think that I will not, right? But he will know that, like, mommy's hot takes on capitalism ruin everything, and he will still love me anyway. So that's how we're setting this up.
Right. That's Dr. Marcia Chatelain, professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown. Her Substack newsletter about fast food and teaching is called Your Favorite Prof. Her book is Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. And hey, big news, just a couple days ago, it was announced that Marcia's book won the Pulitzer Prize in History. Amazing. Congratulations, Marcia. Next time she's on the show, I'll have to introduce her as Pulitzer Prize winning author, Dr. Marcia Chatelain. So now you know Franchise is a great book. Get it wherever books are sold. If you want to hear more McDonald's stories, check out last week's show about the young couple that hacked McDonald's ice cream machines to try to fix them and ended up with private investigators on their tail. It's a good one. It's up now. Next week on the show, we're opening the phone lines. You will call in with your food-related disputes and disagreements, and I'll try to solve them with help from writers Drew McGarry and David Roth of Defector and the Distraction Podcast. That's next week. This show is produced by me, along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern
and producer
Andre Sohara.
Our editor is
Tracy Samuelson.
The show is mixed by
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Peter Clowney and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Johanna from Gainesville, Florida, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.